We need something in life that's for its own sake, or our life is pointless. It doesn't have to be reading difficult books, but that's one major way. And we definitely don't want to be in a situation where we're following our culture in having everything being results driven. Okay, like absolutely everything. So you have to find some beachhead, some territory to mark off and say, this is what my life is really about. This is where my life culminates. It's right here.
Does doctrine really matter? The Apostle Paul once wrote to a young pastor named Titus, instructing him to hold firm to the trustworthy word he was taught, so that he may be able to give instruction in sound doctrine. Welcome to Credo Podcast, where doctrine matters and theological ideas have consequences. Here's your host, Dr. Matthew Barrett, executive editor of Credo Magazine and associate professor of Christian theology at Midwestern Seminary.
Welcome to the Credo Podcast, where doctrine matters and theological ideas have consequences. I am Matthew Barrett, your host. I must make a bit of a confession at the start of this episode. You may not know this about intellectuals or academics or professors that you've met from time to time, but it is actually common that you get to a point where you start to feel a bit disenchanted. There are many reasons why this can happen. I've experienced it myself. For me personally, so much of this happened on the heels of just teaching and just the general education system that we know in America. So much of it was not so much focused on the life of learning, in which there is really a premium on being withdrawn in order to think for its own sake, think about goodness and truth and beauty, the deep things of life, as not just a means but as an end in itself. But in contrast, so much of education actually focuses rather on usefulness. There is a certain pragmatism that can come down quite heavy on both the responsibilities of the student as well as the teacher himself or herself, and ambition is usually not far behind. Whether it's writing books or producing in the classroom or whatnot, there tends to be a focus on what I can get out of it rather than who you are as a person or who you should become. Well, this type of crisis is not unique to me. I remember picking up a book called Lost in Thought, The Hidden Pleasures of an Intellectual Life by Zena Hitz, and just right out of the gate being struck almost over the head, so to speak, by her own story. And I couldn't put the book down because she not only said things that resonated so deeply about the intellectual life, really bringing me back to my first love of learning for its own sake, but she said things that really peered right into my soul, asking questions that were confrontational about my motivations and why it is that I do what I do, why it is that we learn and write and think. Is it just for our own agenda, or is it for some deeper reason that has to do with truth itself? Well, Zena, it really is a pleasure to have you on the Credo Podcast. I should say a word before I let you jump in here just about who you are. If you haven't met her yet, she is tutor in the Great Books program in St. John's College in Maryland. She's also very involved with the Catherine Project, which I would encourage our listeners to go online and check it out. She's the author of Lost in Thought, as I've mentioned, The Hidden Pleasures of an Intellectual Life with Princeton. But she also has a new book that's come out called A Philosopher Looks at the Religious Life. Zena, it really is a joy to have you on the Credo Podcast.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks so much for welcoming me.
Zena, so I resonated so much with a bit of the crisis you had in your own life. Let's just start there. Talk to us about what happened. You were teaching. Here you are, you know, with an advanced degree at an institution, and yet you're finding yourself at some point quite dissatisfied. Maybe I could even go so far to say disenchanted. What happened?
Yeah, it's quite interesting, at least. I mean, of course, it's interesting because it's my life to me, but it's interesting how much of it resonates with other people. I grew up in a family of people who liked books that were amateurs. They weren't professional intellectuals of any kind. And I went to a liberal arts college. I went to St. John's, where I teach now. And so I had a formative experience of books as a part of life, as a part of a process of human reflection, rooted in real experience and directed towards things that really mattered. And I became, through really series of funny chances, very successful academic in elite programs. And something, at first I loved it, and then something started to not feel right. I felt like there was a piece of the world that was missing. Part of it was, I think, something which a number of people in desk jobs can feel, which is a sense that my work wasn't doing anything to alleviate the suffering of the world. You know, there's this tremendous suffering. Young people don't always see it, but as I got older, I started to see just the scope and extent of human suffering, not just in distant places, but even in my neighborhood around me. And I felt like we should do something about it. And I couldn't see how what I was doing was affecting that. Mm. So that happened sort of first, that crisis. And somehow I just kind of kept going because I couldn't quite see what else to do. And then once I started teaching, there was another dimension to the crisis, which is that I really felt like I was doing something pointless in most of my work. Now, I was lucky, and I think most of us are lucky if we have the chance to teach. In every classroom I've ever been in, there's a bit of life. There are people who really want to learn. And if you focus on those people, what you're doing is meaningful. But in a university or in other kinds of schools, sometimes also, a lot of your work is spent just moving people through who don't necessarily want to be there, who haven't been told anything about why they should be there. So the culture of the university doesn't support them. The students themselves don't bring it to them. And they're in your classroom. And there's limits on what you can actually do, especially when you have large numbers. So, you know, you digest your material, you spit it out, they spit it back at you, you give them their B+ or maybe their A- if they do extra work. And that's it. And that was not the kind of thing that I imagined spending my life doing. It was too, it had a kind of emptiness to it.
Yeah.
So anyway, that was how I, that was sort of the two sources of my crisis.
Mm.
Sense of being useless to real suffering, and the sense that I wasn't even doing passing on, you know, the habits of mind that I'd been given as when I was a student myself.
Yeah. As you look back on that time, was there something in particular, or maybe a series of events, that really proved to be a turning point?
Well, there were two main turning points, which I talk about in Lost in Thought. One was in both books, maybe. One was the bombing of the World Trade Center in 2001 when I was a graduate student. I was living about 45 minutes away. I had family members living in the city. It wasn't just the Twin Towers. It was also the war in Afghanistan and the sense that there was this world that was soaked in suffering.
Yeah.
So that was the first thing. And it had an impact on me that lasted for some months. I mean, it was a huge shock. And so the second thing was I had a conversion experience. So I became a Catholic. I suppose that was my first year of teaching, so about 2006, so a few years later. And I had not been brought up with any religion, but it was independent, at least at first, from my midlife crisis. I just was getting older. I thought I should have a religion. I tried some things out. I decided to go Roman Catholic. But once it hit, it started to take on a dimension. It sort of took over my midlife crisis that was already beginning. and gave it a particular shape, a Christian shape.
Mm. Now, one of the things you mentioned just a minute ago was, I really liked how you put it, you know, you're spitting out information, the students spit it back.
Exactly.
You feel at times like, am I just moving people through, you know, am I just a channel? And I know that feeling. I think that probably resonates with a lot of people out there, whether they're teaching at a university or maybe K through 12 or in some other setting. Some of that, I mean, there's all kinds of reasons I suppose we could explore. Why does that happen? Why is that the case? But one of the things you point out in your book, maybe that gets to the root of this issue, is that there's a real difference between learning for results and learning for the love of the object for its own sake. And, you know, there's been different labels put on this. Sometimes people will speak of classical education, where you will see this emphasized. But back to your own story, can you help us? I think for some of our listeners, that might be new to them. And some of them may even have advanced degrees or be teaching at, you know, advanced institutions. But they find themselves really just processing things for the sake of results, whether those are, you know, the results of those who are learning or their own career or their own CV or whatnot. What is the difference? Why is that such a major difference? Why should we not take that difference for granted?
Well, the difference between learning for results and learning for its own sake, I think it really is important. It's not always straightforward in practice, which I think is one reason why it's not recognized. Mm. So you can see it most clearly, I think, if you know, one of the reasons why I love stories about people in prison or people in very difficult circumstances who have taken on a learning project, you know, they're reading Shakespeare on breaks from their backbreaking job, or they're in, you know, in prison, like Malcolm X, studying poetry and reading all the history of the world. One of the reasons why I like those examples is because there, I think you can really see that these people are doing it. They've got nothing else in it, but how it develops them as human beings, as people, as something that changes your way of being.
Yeah.
And I think most of us know, if we don't recognize it in ourselves, most of us know someone who's like that, who's just, they get electric about some topic of learning and they're not interested in it because of what it gets them. They're interested in it because it fascinates them and because thinking about the topic helps them to grow and to reimagine things and so on. So it's very important, and it's important in part because we need something in life that's for its own sake, or our life is pointless. It doesn't have to be reading difficult books, but that's one major way. And we definitely don't want to be in a situation where we're following our culture in having everything being results driven.
Yeah.
Okay, like absolutely everything. So you have to find some beachhead, some territory to mark off and say, this is what my life is really about. This is where my life culminates. It's right here. And there's a lot of texture that place can have. For most people, it's, you know, their families, it's time with their families, it's time in church, it's time in prayer. But of course, also things that might be considered hobbies, being outdoors, hunting, gardening, etc. And then beyond that, you want art, music, thinking and learning and studying and understanding. You want as rich a human life as you can have in that little piece of territory, which is where your life culminates. And that prepares you for all kinds of things that life can throw in your way, apart from anything else.
Mm. You know, when you were just describing that, there's a certain dignity to it,
right,
that I don't see very often today. And I think some of this goes back to a word that, well, it's a word that really means something different today than it used to mean in previous centuries. It's the word leisure.
Right.
What's the difference between, I think when people think of leisure today, you know, you might meet someone who says, "Oh, I'm a person of leisure." You know, if they even speak that way, they probably mean something like recreation.
Right.
But what you're talking about has far more to do with going inward for the sake of contemplation. What is the difference between leisure and recreation?
I think one way you can tell the difference is by asking the question, is this where my life culminates? Is this what it's all about? Because there are many activities which are pleasant, they're recreational. So, you know, lying on the beach, you know, going on a nice trip. But you wouldn't say, yes, if this was all I ever did with my life, it would be worth living. You wouldn't say if an asteroid hit tomorrow, I would have no regrets. So you want an activity that really that the rest of your life in some way could be said to be for. Where, okay, not all of us can have the luxury of intellectual profession or a meaningful profession. Sometimes our work is just a drag. And maybe it's even dehumanizing or demoralizing in some way. But if we have some piece of our life that's not for results, then it's a type of freedom that we have in our leisure.
Yeah. One person just from history that I know this person's been instrumental in your life. He's been very instrumental in my own life, especially early on. I remember reading Augustine. Goodness, I don't even think I was 20 years old. And Augustine having not just a profound influence in terms of his ideas, but the way he thought about everything from who God is to what to make of sometimes a very chaotic world around him, to what the church is to be in the midst of all of that. Augustine, I think one of the things I realized very quickly was out of all the books I was reading, not many of the authors thought the way Augustine did. And by that, I don't just mean content, but I mean contemplation itself. What you spend a lot of time on Augustine is not just his thought, but his intellectual life as almost a model in a sense. What is it about Augustine's way of thinking that might help us here?
Well, I think if someone listening knows Augustine's Confessions, which we should all know, it's a wonderful book. You know, if you put it on your bucket list if it's not there already. he has all kinds of pursuits. He has a career. He's a rhetoric teacher, which in the Roman Empire where he lives could be quite lucrative, could get you quite to high places. A results-driven career. You know, he would have been on a certain kind of career track if he were today. You know, he'd be in STEM or engineering or, you know, coding or one of these places that's going to sort of get you up there. Yet he is thinking and reflecting independently from his job. That's one thing. Mm-hmm. Really, what's remarkable is his thinking is deeply connected to the way that he's going to live his life. So he's pursuing wisdom in a way that a lot of, you know, it's not as fashionable, I suppose, nowadays as it might have been in previous eras or in other cultures. He's searching for wisdom that is a type of understanding that's going to shape his whole life. And make his whole life into a different kind of thing and can provide for the deepest kinds of satisfaction that life can get you. And we might think of that as something you might find in the self-help section. We wouldn't think, oh, I have to read philosophy in order to do that. I have to read, you know, these things that can seem quite dense or difficult in order to get to the bottom of these things. But Augustine did see it that way. So that's one thing that he can help us with. It's not actually the part I talk about in the book directly, but it's part of it, the search for wisdom.
Hi, friends. This is Matthew Barrett. I'm interrupting this conversation to tell you about something quite exciting. Each November, we have a special meeting hosted by the Center for Classical Theology. This is an arm of Credo, and it's an opportunity to come together once a year in order to hear a lecture from a well-known theologian in order to renew and restore classical theology today. This November, Michael Horton will be giving this lecture, and he will be addressing us in San Diego, California, talking to us about what it means to affirm sola scriptura as it was originally intended, and how we do that in light of Catholicity. I look forward to hearing what he has to say, followed by a panel of other theologians discussing it as well. I hope you will join me in San Diego this November. Yeah, I mean, that search for wisdom, which for Augustine ultimately results in a love of wisdom himself. This is so telling. I mean, he talks about this in Confessions. He also expands upon it in City of God as he's interacting with these Platonist books that prove to be transformative for him, though not the end, a means to the end, because they help him, in a sense, they give him a more transcendent view of God so that his eyes are almost reopened to the scriptures and what they have to say about Christ. And he talks about it like going to the mountaintop to see over the trees order to see the way to Zion itself. And that really changes him.
Yeah, and that's right.
It's that contemplative mindset, though, that is not so, it's not just instrumental for, say, his conversion, though it is, but it really sets him on a whole trajectory so that whether he's writing Confessions or his colossal work on the Trinity, it's always in that spirit. I think one thing I've noticed both with your writing and then Augustine as well, and you make this point that there is a real difference between the love of learning, as you call it, and the love of spectacle. With the love of learning, and this is where Augustine's such an example, he's moving past the surface. You even feel it when he's not converted yet. He's desperate, in a sense, to get to what's real, and quite hungry and dissatisfied with everything that's not quite getting him there. You know, his whole experience with Manichaeism. It's different, though, than the love of spectacle. In which you're moving object to object, you're living more by the thrill of experience. I mean, I hope this goes without saying for our listeners, but that is very much the world of our day, given the use of social media, even the way that news works, or just what people value. And it's not so much virtue anymore, as it is, as you call it, more of a thrill of what's next or what's the next high in societal life. So can you, Zena, can you help us here? Because I think this is that point at which I felt, and I know I'm not alone in saying this, but this is where you feel really uncomfortable. You feel like, oh, wow, she's talking about me. Why?
I'm talking about myself, too.
Yeah. Yeah, I noticed that. why is it the case that it makes us feel so uncomfortable? But why is that a good thing in the end?
Well, so I think you're exactly right. The part of the book about the love of spectacles and the difference between something which pushes past the surface and goes to the depths, it really is, in a way, a part of the core of the book, especially for people now, because, and it's exactly as you say, it's because the technology that we have, it makes our spectacles, if anything, even thinner and less, makes them easier to get and even less contentful and more dangerous than they might have been. And I think as an example, it's not just for intellectual life that it's such a big problem. If you think about the way that social media has made people sort of addicted to getting angry about political events, that is their main political emotion is anger and envy. And that's not a coincidence that nothing is working very well anymore, because if you're working on anger, that's not going to help you repair your roadways. It's not going to help you, you know, find solutions to tough difficulties. You're just going to kind of keep sort of binging on your anger for its own sake. So it's a big deal, I think, this love of spectacle. It's not just about the life of the mind. And as far as, you know, I think that the search for wisdom, the life of the mind, where that's understood as a search for growth, a search for understanding, it's going to involve uncomfortable moments where we recognize ourselves, because so much of our life, I mean, why do we spend all this time looking at these little pixels images? I mean, why? You know, I mean, I'm sure we all ask ourselves this question, you know, 3 hours later when you realize you've been spending all this time, you went on for one thing, and then 3 hours later, you're like, am I still, what's going on? Is it dinner time already? And I think that the reason what keeps us there is exactly that desire to avoid that discomfort. There's stuff in ourselves we don't want to face. Our loneliness, our problems, difficulties, various things that are going to take some humility, especially to overcome. And we don't like to be humble. We want to feel comfortable and safe and secure in who we are. And the internet's just pouring that into us all the time, so that we never, ever, you know, I mean, thanks be to God, right? We can tell something's wrong usually, and you can pull back and you can say, wow, I feel awful. Why? I was on the internet all day. That's why I feel so awful. So we have some checks and balances, but that's what it's feeding. It's feeding our desire to avoid any kind of discomfort, and making ourselves more comfortable with a bit of discomfort is crucial for us, to our well-being.
Yeah. You have this great moment where you talk about, you know, people walking around with their smartphones and how it's comfortable, because if we look up and we see other people, it's a bit ironic, right? Because on the one hand, we think we're so engaged with people. At all the people we can interact with. And yet we're extremely uncomfortable with looking up from our phones and seeing a person in the flesh before us. And you make this point that, well, that's an encounter. That's a real encounter. And it's very risky. It's a risky encounter, because we look up, and let's just be honest, it's much easier to keep looking down and over something we can control rather than looking up and having to talk and not knowing what kind of conversation that may be or could be. There's a certain hyperactivity that then, you know, comes alongside and kind of fuels that whole process.
Or you think about difficulties in your workplace or in a school or something like that.
Yeah.
That face-to-face confrontation with someone who's causing you a difficulty, so hard, right? But posting online about it, or chatting, texting to your friends, so easy. It's so easy. Yeah. So again, this is a cause of dysfunction, because, you know, social life requires that if something's not working, that we look each other in the eye and say, you know what, I'm having a difficulty. Can you help me out?
Yeah,
because when you do this, it makes me lose my mind. But we don't have that. You know, younger people are really out of the habit of those kinds of conversations, and we older people are not so good at it anymore either. And it's yet another cost of the life on the screen.
Yes, I remember this just the other day, and I was going to call someone on the phone, and my wife said, "What are you doing? People don't do that anymore. Just text them." and it occurred to me, I felt like I was losing something in that moment, because I thought, well, I want to talk to them. It was easier in the end. It was easier. I didn't risk as much. But in the end, I felt like I lost something, something quite essential. Now, I think what you said, though, a minute ago really touches on a nerve, because I think you used the language of confrontation.
Right.
Maybe we can just dwell here, you know, be a little bit more comfortable for just another second, because you make a great point when you say, listen, this is where real real change happens with confrontation that confounds us. And I think that if I had to guess, I think that a lot of people think, oh, I'm doing that. I'm going through that transformation because I have opinions and I'm voicing all of my opinions. And I'm doing so to, you know, hundreds, thousands of people at once. But you push back against that and you say, well, the exchange of opinions, that gives more of a veneer of tolerance, but not, it's not necessarily like a serious thinking. And it doesn't push you to that moment of confrontation itself where you're having an actual exchange of ideas with intellectual engagement. You're confounded at some point. Yes, it's uncomfortable, but you might actually be moved to a place of reconciliation. Talk to us about this because this is very illuminating. What is this difference between just sharing opinions and true engagement with ideas that leads to change?
Well, I'm going to be blunt here, if that's all right.
Yes, please.
I mean, opinions are basically garbage. They're little slogans or thoughts. They get embedded in your mind through one experience or another. They can change. They change very often with your social circumstances, you know. So, you know, I'm sure a lot of your listeners are familiar. You know, your kids are brought up going to church. They go away to college. They meet a different group of people. And suddenly they're like, oh, I don't talk about that anymore.
Yeah.
What happened? Did they actually think through the arguments? No. They just got in a different social group. And so they started using a different language. And so their opinions changed. And it feels like a deep change, but it's not. Because unless you've really dug into yourself and confronted something seriously, which a lot of forces in our community are not wanting us to do, then you're not really thinking about things. And it's a different situation than someone who, you know, sort of puzzles and says, you know what, there's so much suffering in the world, I think there might not be a God. And you know, and you're like, well, that's an honest struggle. Okay, this is a person who's dealing with a real problem that anyone with a deep faith has to face. That's not what it's about. It's just like, these people don't think that's cool, I'm going to change my mind. And a lot of us do that all the time without even thinking about it. So opinions are, they're sort of flotsam and jetsam. They're words and slogans. They ride on our emotions. They ride on our feelings. And real reflection, in my experience, involves setting aside opinions. You just set them aside. You don't necessarily examine them, which is the way that a lot of people will talk. You set them aside and you ask yourself a fundamental question like, okay, what do I think a just society looks like?
Yeah.
What makes living things different from non-living things? Okay, that sounds like a dumb question, but it's a really, really interesting question, right?
Yeah.
What's the difference and how do we understand it? And why do we recognize it so quickly? Something that's alive and something that's not alive, big difference. If you encounter fundamental questions, first of all, you can talk to people you disagree with because you're not talking about the thing that drives you crazy, but you're not talking about the terms of conflict. And secondly, you're getting down deep underneath your opinions, you're getting to the things that you really care about, that you really think about, and you're in a sober, thoughtful mindset, which means that you might end up committed to some of your thoughts because you've really thought them through with some other people, you know, and doing some good reading and all these kinds of things. So there's a level of mental functioning connected to our emotions and our feelings also where we're really in the depths. We're not just skittering across the surface with opinions.
Yeah.
So this is the thing that I'm still sort of on the soapbox about, because a lot of times, right, even in college classes, people don't like discussion classes because what does it do? The teacher or the professor is just like, well, what do you guys think? What's your opinion? And then you have to hear one mouth off and you haven't learned anything.
Yeah.
And one of the things you could ask yourself is, well, why does it seem like I don't learn anything when I hear other people's opinions? It's because they're not deep enough. They're too superficial. And our thinking happens at a different level than that.
You know, when we talk about these opinions, I also find that they're very tethered to pride or,
right,
with that ambition. And maybe this is a, I want to make sure I give you the last word here, Zena, because I think this is where things could really change for the better. I love that you talked about the Neapolitan novels by Ferrante. These, to our listeners, if you haven't read those, they're quite deep. And Zena touches on them to raise some questions about not just the intellectual life, but humility itself. What is it about, as you call it, the opinionization of our society that leads to not just things like competition in an unhealthy way or, say, laziness on the other hand, but you also talk about how there's a reduction in which we're motivated by fear, not all that unlike what you just mentioned. How do we, I mean, if our listeners are really going to try and say, okay, I'm going to try to go beyond the surface of just hearing opinions and just being comfortable with, you know, hearing my own opinions, how do they do that in a way that avoids maybe the trappings of ambition that can really come up no matter what the career? I mean, we see them all the time with politics, right?
Right.
That's a very, you know, conspicuous example, but it really does come up all the time in other areas as well. How do we avoid that trapping to somehow get down to engaging ideas, but doing so with the humility that, frankly, we see in someone like Christ himself?
You know, I don't know whether you're expecting this answer or if it will surprise you, but I really think that you get something like that when you read books that are challenging with other people, the books, you know, that people have been reading for centuries, Augustine's Confessions, Plato's Dialogues, Shakespeare, you know, Jane Austen. In the books, especially, now they're hard to read, so you've got to have other people to read them with, which is why I have this organization called the Catherine Project, so people have a way to do that wherever they are.
Yeah.
But when you read things like that, you're going out of your own experience, you're going out of your own time and place, you're entering into something that's more deeply human, and you're seeing things as you wouldn't otherwise. Now, I don't want to diminish the sacrifice of Christ, which is, you know, that's the most profound humility there is. But there is a sense, right, where out of love, he becomes a slave, right? He empties himself and takes the form of a slave. Now, out of love, we too can empty ourselves and really try to step sympathetically into someone else's time, someone else's place, someone else's circumstances. I mean, Difficult Books is the way that I promote most often. Of course, many people also know you can do that through forms of service, direct person-to-person service.
Yeah.
It is any encounter with a suffering person, that's in a nursing home, if that's in a prison, if that's something like that, you know, any encounter like that, it humbles you because you recognize yourself and the other person, and you have to be elemental. You have to get down to what really matters to you and what really matters to the other person in the search for common ground. So that's my advice for conducting oneself with humility and breaking out of these traps that our contemporary world offers to us.
Now you can fill up on theology each day by visiting credomag.com. There you will find the latest issues of Credo Magazine with articles on key doctrines of the faith, and regular video interviews with Dr. Matthew Barrett, where he answers some of the toughest theological questions of our day. Be sure to subscribe to Credo Podcasts to join the conversation, a conversation where doctrine matters.